The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
These little talks, we've now and then touched upon the question of the fulfillment of the prophecies. What was it that the prophets had in mind when they spoke of the future? I want at this time to mention the view that I'm going to discuss more in detail when we come to the 70 weeks. That is the parenthesis view of the church, that the prophets had in mind not the church and its work, not the church corporately, not the preaching of the gospel, the establishing of churches and so on, but they had in mind rather the future of the actual nation Israel. And that nation is to receive a future during a period known as the millennium. Now, the word millennium means 1,000 years, and that phrase occurs in the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation. It's not a frequently occurring phrase in the Old Testament. You might wonder why it is that anyone would want to put the fulfillment of all the prophecies in the millennium. And I think the basic answer that can be given, I believe this is a fair thing to say, is that men look at the prophecies and see their predictions of great blessing, and then they look at the world round about us and realize that this blessing, at least they think it, is not here. Therefore, they conclude there must be some other period in which the prophecies are to find their fulfillment, and that period is called the millennium. Now, this view that the prophets spoke about a great age to come, a glorious age to come, has been present since early days of the church. Papias was a premillennialist, and Eusebius spoke of him. I don't know if he had this in mind or not, but he spoke of him in the Greek language as being Sophodra Mikron Ton Noon, which means exceedingly small as far as his mind was concerned. I don't think, however, that it was with respect to this particular point that he spoke that way, but he is an example of an early believer that the prophecies would find a fulfillment upon this earth. Now, this millennium is to come in the future from us, so we are told. But will Jesus Christ return first? Those who hold that hold to what is called a premillennial view, that the next thing in order is the return of Christ. And then those who hold that Christ will return after the millennium has run its course hold what is called a postmillennial view. You may have heard of the view, the amillennialist, and the preposition or the prefix a simply means away from there being a millennium. That is, those who hold this view do not believe that the millennium means a period of 1,000 years in which there will be a Jewish kingdom, a Jewish reign. They have another interpretation of the millennium. They may differ among themselves as to what that is, but I would ask you to remember that the millennium, the 1,000 years, akilia ete, as it is in the Greek, occurs in the 20th chapter of Revelation, and this is a symbolic book. And I think this particular passage has to be understood in the light of the general structure of the book of Revelation. But I am not able to agree, as I've been trying to point out, that we can simply look at the prophecies and say they're not being fulfilled today, so they obviously don't refer to today, and therefore they must be fulfilled in the future. And I have tried to lay the groundwork to show that neither can we say the great majority of fulfilled prophecies have been fulfilled literally. Therefore, those that are not fulfilled will be fulfilled literally. And inasmuch as they're not being fulfilled today, they're to be fulfilled in the millennium. I simply would challenge that type of reasoning. I don't think that's scriptural at all. And the defense of the view that the prophecies must find fulfillment in the millennium must be based, I think, upon better arguments than that. But now we come this afternoon to begin the consideration of one of these prophecies that has been fulfilled. And this is not an incidental prophecy, but it is the very culmination, you might say, of messianic prophecy. And this has already been fulfilled. Now, if these prophecies were to be fulfilled in the future, we might expect that this one would be also. For I do not think we can actually say that this has been literally fulfilled. Again, we are faced with the question as to how the prophecies must be fulfilled. So here, well, I would have you notice that this prophecy, which is a kind of a capstone of all of the Old Testament prophecies, refers to the work of Christ and not to something that occurs in the future. And I think it is very difficult to take many of these prophecies from the prophets, refer them to the work of Christ, and then pick out others and say these must apply to something that is in the distant future. I think it is only fair to say that the earlier premillennialists spoke in a rather vague and general way about the fulfillment of prophecy. They did not had not studied it as we have today, and we really owe a debt of gratitude to the Plymouth Brethren because they have forced us to turn our attention to the question of the fulfillment of prophecy as perhaps we had not been doing. A great many have neglected the study of prophecy altogether, and you will find that many ministers do not preach upon it. One man said to me, "I just don't know what the prophets are talking about." And I felt like replying, "Well, if you did a little study, you'd find out," but I didn't. And I think that this has been a somewhat neglected study, a neglected field, but it is a very rewarding and rich field. Now, we come then to consider what is the capstone of the prophecies which deal with the servant of the Lord. The phrase servant of the Lord in itself simply refers to one who serves God, carrying out his will. You remember that Christ, when he was upon earth, said, "Lo, I come to do thy will." In the volume of the book it is written of me. And I am inclined to think that we may subsume the work of Christ under the term obedience. Christ's whole ministry was a ministry of obedience. We speak of the active obedience of Christ, and by that we mean his life upon earth, his positive obeying of God's law. He actively obeyed the law of God, which Adam transgressed, in order that thereby he might obtain for his people the title to everlasting life. And we speak also of the passive obedience of Christ, whereby he was obedient even unto death, and in his very death obeyed the will of God that he might save his people from their sins. So the whole work of Christ may be subsumed under that work, obedience. Christ, then, is the servant of the Lord. In writing to the Philippians, you remember that Paul says, "Who being in the form of God, thought the being on an equality with God was not a thing to be grasped, but humbled himself, and took upon him the form of a servant." That's a definite allusion to this messianic prophecy. And Christ himself, in rebuking those who wanted to be first in the kingdom, said, "Even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom in the stead of many." Mark has often been called the gospel of the servant, and rightly so. So that Christ's whole work is a work of servant, a work of obedience. The servant of the Lord, then, is the one who serves God, who carries out his will. Now, in the latter part of the book of Isaiah, Israel, the nation, is spoken of as the servant of the Lord. And that was to be the function of Israel. That nation was to serve God, to be a light, to lighten the Gentiles, and so on. Israel failed rather miserably at that, and did not show herself to be the true servant. But then there is one set forth in this second part of Isaiah, who is the servant par excellence, who is all that Israel should have been and was not. But who is this servant? Now you will find that there is mention made of him in chapter 42, in chapter 49, in chapter 50, in chapter 52:13 through 53:12, and again in chapter 51. There are five passages at least where this servant stands out. He is distinct from the servant Israel. And the great question that has to be answered here is, who is this servant? Now, possibly we can get at that by calling to mind the question of the Ethiopian eunuch. You remember that the Ethiopian eunuch had been to Jerusalem, and on his return he was seated in his chariot reading the prophecy of Isaiah. And he was reading from the 53rd chapter, but he did not understand what he was reading. And when the evangelist Philip was sent to him, he asked him, "Understandest thou what thou readest?" And he said, "How should I, except someone should explain it to me?" And so he asked this question, "Of whom saith the prophet these things?" Now it's a rather interesting question that he asks. He asks, does he say these things of himself, or does he speak of another man? The eunuch evidently believed that the prophet was speaking about an individual, either himself or some other man. It does not seem to have entered the eunuch's mind that he was speaking about a group of people. And I don't find any evidence that the eunuch thought he was speaking about a corporate personality. It was simply an individual, either himself or some other person. Now, up until the time of the Second World War, there have been two basic interpretations of the servant. One could be called the individualistic, that is, it is a group of interpretations which finds the servant to be an individual. The other is collectivistic, and those interpretations find that the servant is a group of people, not an individual. Now let's look at that latter group first of all. Those who say that the servant is a group of people say that it is the nation Israel, or it is the prophets, or it is the better class of the nation Israel, or it is those who came through the exile, or it is the teachers of the law, something like that. Now, there have been advocates of this view right along, I say, up until the Second World War. There may be some even today. But there are certain things that seem to rule this out. First of all, it's very difficult to think that the servant is the nation Israel. The servant in Isaiah 53 is set forth as obedient, as submissive to the will of God, as one who obeys God. Israel, on the other hand, is set forth as recalcitrant, as stubborn, as rebellious, as sinful. Furthermore, the description in Isaiah 53 is so personalized that it does not seem even to apply to a nation that might be personified. And I think we need to keep those considerations in mind. But now suppose you say that the servant is an individual. Who is that individual? In the long history of interpretation, I guess about 15 different names have been presented. Some have said that the individual was Isaiah himself. Others have said that it was Jeremiah. Others have said that it was Meshulam. Others have, because in 42 it says, "Who is blind as Meshulam?" A very difficult word which may mean the perfected one. And one man wrote a doctoral thesis to show that the servant was Meshulam. That, I think, has almost nothing to commend it. Dr. Selin, a professor in the University of Berlin, changed his mind a number of times. First, he said the servant is Zerubbabel. 2 years later, he wrote another thesis in which he said the servant was Jehoiakim. And then, fooling around with the text of Hosea and trying to make some textual emendations, he came up with the idea that the servant was Moses and that Moses had been slaughtered in Shittim. Now, I think there's a lesson that we all ought to take to heart, and that is we should never put anything down in writing, write an article on the Bible, unless we have counted at least to 10. And no sooner had Selin written this thesis showing that Moses was martyred at Shittim than Sigmund Freud got a hold of it and wrote his book on Moses and monotheism. Now, that sells for 35 cents in the United States, and I think it's too expensive. But Sigmund Freud adopted this view that there were two men by the name of Moses. The work is utterly worthless as far as any contribution to biblical study is concerned. It is simply based upon an emendation in the text of Hosea that Saline had made. Then after doing all of that, Saline changed his view again. And this time he maintained that the servant was speaking of himself, but himself was not Isaiah, but second Isaiah. Now, in saying that, Saline had been influenced by others. In 1920, I believe it was, someone came out, I think it was Mowinckel, came out with the view that the servant was second Isaiah and that he was speaking about himself. Now, when we write a book, we can usually take safety or refuge in the fact that there can be a second edition. And if we've been fortunate enough to find any errors in our book before the book reviewers find them, we can change them in the second edition. But book reviewers, you know, are just like vultures. They're waiting to pounce on everything, and if they can spot an error, they bring it to the fore, and that's what they did. So they said, how can the servant be second Isaiah? How can he be talking about himself? Because in the 53rd chapter, he dies and comes to life again. And second Isaiah knew that that had never happened to him. Well, that wasn't too difficult. In the second edition of this book, the same thesis was presented. The servant is second Isaiah, but the one who wrote this passage is third Isaiah. So, that was the view that Saline finally adopted. Zerubbabel, Jehoiakim, Moses, second Isaiah. And you get the impression that none of these views convinced their own author. So they aren't too strong. They aren't very strong views. Then there have been others proposed for the servant. And of course, the traditional view in the church has been, the view that the New Testament presents, that the servant is Jesus Christ, and that I believe is correct. Why do men not accept that view? Well, to accept that view, you have to hold to predictive prophecy. And if you hold to predictive prophecy, that means you're holding to a mechanistic view of the universe. You're holding that things have been determined in advance. Apparently that's bad. So we cannot hold that. Now, it is perfectly true that we cannot understand any of these questions unless we approach them on theistic presuppositions. And it seems to me that the Bible teaches that God is all-powerful and that God has foreordained whatsoever comes to pass, that there is no such thing as chance, and that if a man utters predictive prophecy, he does not know the future on his own. He knows the future because he has received a revelation from God. God knows what will occur because God has ordained what will occur. Now, I know there are problems involved in predestination and human responsibility, but it seems to me the only thing a Christian can do is accept the biblical position of faith, and that is believe in predestination because the Bible teaches it, and believe in human responsibility because the Bible teaches that. And you and I cannot harmonize those with our finite minds, but they are harmonized in God. And that should be sufficient for us. And rather than predestination destroying our zeal for the work of the Lord, those who really believe in this doctrine and are convinced that God is sovereign are the ones that are most zealous to exercise their human responsibility and to see that the gospel is preached. But nevertheless, that's the principal objection that I know of against saying that this prophecy finds its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. Now, I'd like to offer one defense of this position right at the start before we begin studying the prophecy. And that is this: the servant is pictured as one who performs a spiritual work. I mean by that, his work is not to deliver people from physical bondage, but his work is to deliver them from the guilt and the power of their sins. That is a spiritual work. And there is only one of whom it may be said that he has done that, and that is Jesus Christ. In other words, this passage fits the work of Christ. It is speaking of him. And the minute you begin to apply it to someone else, you realize how difficult it is. Now, the Jews have varied in their interpretation of this passage. There are three large volumes which deal with the history of the interpretation of Isaiah 53 among the Jews. Some of them hold an individualistic view, some hold a collectivistic view. But now, since the Second World War, a new type of interpretation has come into effect. It is almost uncanny the change in the theological world that has come about since the close of the First World War, and especially during the Second World War. Now there has come an emphasis upon what is called corporate personality. I think that much of this goes back to the irrationalism that is expressed in Kierkegaard and in other writings, for irrationalism seems to be in the fore today. And there is the endeavor to explain everything in the Bible upon the basis of something outside of the Bible. Every religious practice of Israel must go back to a religious practice elsewhere. Hence, we come to study the servant motif. And what I am going to say is based upon the writings of Professor H.S. Nieberg of Uppsala, who has written a long article on Isaiah 53. It's never been translated into English. But he maintains that we must look for the basis of this servant conception. If we do that, we find it in three different places. There is, first of all, the Thomas Aquinas rites of Babylon. They are reflected in the verse, for example, "He shall grow up before him as a root out of a dry ground." And then we are to look also at the conception of corporate personality that was found in Israel. That is, the eponymous ancestor Israel and Jacob is bound up with the fortunes of his nation, who also have his name. When you say, therefore, Israel suffers, it's not only the nation that suffers, but its ancestor also suffers. He is bound up with the nation. That is what they mean by corporate personality. I'm not sure that the English is the best term, but that is a widely used expression today. Then in the third place, there is the old ideology of the kingship, supposedly held in ancient Israel. All of those concepts go to make up the concept of the servant of the Lord. Actually, the servant is a myth. Now, when we say myth, we have to ask what is meant, because everybody that uses that term uses it in his own way. Usually, when we think of myths, we think of those stories about the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses that we learned in grammar school and high school. But that isn't exactly what is meant today. The Greek word mythos means simply a word. And so when we say that the servant is a word, what Professor Nieberg and others mean, I think, is that this was a word that was recited annually in the cult, that's a favorite term, in the cult of Israel, in the worship services of Israel. Every year there was a recitation of Isaiah 53, of this myth, as he calls it. And the three sources of this myth I have just mentioned. Then Professor Nieberg concludes by saying that, therefore, it is wrong to say that the servant is an individual or that the servant is a group. He is both an individual and a group. He is neither an individual nor a group, as you will. Furthermore, he is not a present figure, nor a past figure, nor a future figure, but he is a present figure and a past figure and a future figure. Now, what I like about that is that you know exactly what he means. That is irrationalism, of course. But that is very widespread today, a thing both is and is not. Another view of Isaiah 53, which is of essentially the same nature, and I think to which Professor Nieberg would also subscribe in its essentials, has been presented by the late Professor Engnell, also of the University of Uppsala in Sweden. And that is that this is a myth. It is a myth recited annually in the cult. He agrees with Nieberg there. And when we study this as scientific scholars, that is the only conclusion to which we can come. It has absolutely nothing to do with Jesus Christ. It was something that the Hebrews recited annually in their cult. The only addition that they made to the old tradition was that they saw in this a future figure. That's all. Nevertheless, as a Christian in the realm of faith, we can believe that the prophet is speaking of Jesus Christ, that this is a prophecy of Christ. In the realm of faith, this is a prophecy of Christ. In the realm of scientific scholarship, this is not a prophecy of Christ. It's simply an old myth recited in the cults. Now that again is irrationalism. A thing cannot both be and not be at the same time. It is that which undergirds so much of modern theology. Modern theologians make a distinction between historie, the German word for history, which refers to that which has taken place on this earth and which we can study as historians, and Geschichte, which is another German word meaning history. Now, they come to face the great doctrines of Christianity. And you might say something like this: Sennacherib's invasion took place in historie. That is, by studying documents, I can find out something about that invasion. But the resurrection of Christ, the virgin birth, the creation, and so on, belong in that realm of Geschichte. Now, there are different names given to that. And Professor Engnell, you see, uses one name. Instead of saying historie, he says the realm of scientific investigation. Instead of saying Geschichte, he says the realm of faith. Now, I do not know what positive content these men, Barth and the rest, put in this realm of Geschichte. Barth, despite all of his writing, has never been very clear on that subject. But it seems to me that as soon as you take these events out of historie, out of what we would call true history, you have really put them in a realm of myth and legend and so on. If the resurrection of Jesus Christ took place in Geschichte, it did not take place on the third day, a calendar day, after the atonement, and it was not a miracle, and the body of the Lord did not emerge from the tomb. And to say, I believe in the resurrection, when you believe in something in Geschichte, is really to be deceptive. And to say that I believe that this is a prophecy of Jesus Christ, but only in the realm of faith is that so, whereas in historie, or through studying this scientifically, I find that it has nothing at all to do with Jesus Christ, but is simply an old cult myth, that seems to me to be very deceptive. And I cannot help but feel that the great weakness in neo-orthodoxy, in dialectical theology, in its various manifestations, is the basic irrationality that underlies it. It can't hold the field, because the world is not irrational, and sooner or later that will be manifest. I think there are already signs that it is beginning to go, and it begins to look as though the older modernism is going to come back in its place, but at any rate, irrationality cannot hold the field. And that is the objection that has to be made to some of these modern interpretations of the servant of the Lord. Either Isaiah is speaking of Christ or he is not, but he can't both be doing it and not be doing it at the same time. We have to reject most vigorously anything that smacks of irrationalism, because we know that this is not an irrational world. Very well then, we have many attempts at studying this passage. Right now, I think there is a dearth of literature on Isaiah 53. For some reason, scholars just have nothing to say about the passage, and there's been very little of a constructive nature that has been written on it in the last few years. I think Professor Nieberg's article comes about as close to it as any, for despite his rather wild interpretation, he makes some very good points in his detailed exposition of the passage. He also engages in a very strong defense of the text of the passage. And that, it seems to me, is all to the good. Now we look at the situation and we find this. In the second part of the book of Isaiah, the prophet looks to the future. I can see no reason why he could not have written this under the reign of Hezekiah, after the invasion of Sennacherib. He looks to the future and he sees his people in bondage. Yes, in bondage to Babylon. I'm willing to grant a certain Babylonian coloring to these later chapters. We should notice, however, that Babylon is mentioned more often in the first part of the book than it is in the second part of the book, and Egypt is mentioned just as much in the second part of the book as Babylon is. There really is very little explicit mention of Babylon. Some commentaries give you the impression that that Babylonian background shines out everywhere, but they read a great deal of it into the text. It just is not there. But nevertheless, there is reference to Babylon. And Isaiah does see his people in bondage. Now, from the biblical theological standpoint, I think that's what we should expect. The exile, as I've said several times, is a punishment of God because of the sins of the people. The theocracy comes to an end. The people then are in exile. They are in bondage. And from that physical bondage, there is to be deliverance, and that is to be accomplished by Cyrus. Cyrus was the Persian king, as we said the other day. He came down and conquered Babylon. Cyrus made it possible for the people to return to their land. But that is not all that Isaiah says. He sets forth the truth that the people were in bondage of a far greater nature than any physical bondage could possibly be. They were in bondage to sin. It was a spiritual bondage that enslaved them. And from this spiritual bondage, there is deliverance by the servant of the Lord. I do not agree that Isaiah expected this deliverance to come from Cyrus and then was disappointed and turned to the servant of the Lord. I think rather that Cyrus served his function. But the great deliverance is the work of the servant of the Lord. In chapter 42, this servant is first introduced. In chapter 49, he again appears, and then in 50, and then in 52:13 through 53:12. Now it is this latter passage that we shall consider. Isaiah presents the servant in 42 as accomplishing a great mission, the setting of judgment in the world, and shows that he will be successful in his mission. Then in 49, the servant complains that he has labored in vain, and we wonder why that is. In chapter 50, he speaks of undergoing persecution. I gave my back to the smiters, he said, and my cheek to those that pluck out the hair. And the question arises, why is this so? Why did the servant undergo this physical persecution and suffering? The answer to those questions is given to us in the 53rd chapter. And so the 53rd chapter is essential if we are to understand the nature of the servant's work. It begins with chapter 52, verse 13, and I want to read these three verses. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. As many were astonished at thee, his vision was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle many nations. The king shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they perceive. There is the introduction to the passage, and you'll notice that this is all in the future. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. The verbs are futures here. Then if you come down to the conclusion of the passage, beginning in the middle of verse 10, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and so on. From verse 10 to the end of the chapter, again, everything is placed in the future. That gives us the setting. But then if you look at the middle of the chapter, beginning at verse 1 of 53 and going down to the middle of verse 10, you will find that all of the verbs are in the past. Who hath believed our report? And the arm of the Lord upon whom has it been revealed? And then the next really is, and he grew up before him. Vayaal, it is the wav consecutive with the imperfect and must be translated by the past there. The whole body of the passage is in the past. Now my explanation of this is that it is like the prophetic perfect of Isaiah 9. simply for the sake of variety, the prophet does not use the future throughout. But the body of the passage he puts in the past in order to express the certainty that it will be fulfilled. But the introduction and the conclusion set the time element very clearly and show us that we must translate with respect to the future. If you take this chapter and make it refer to some past figure and think that the prophet is describing something that has already occurred, then of course the great question is just who is the prophet talking about? And there is no one in the history of Israel to whom these words apply. No one has held the field for any length of time, for all you have to do is mention anyone to realize that the passage does not apply indiscriminately to anybody that might be produced. It makes a great deal of sense when it applies to Jesus Christ. It doesn't really make very much sense if it applies to anybody else. So I think that the prophet is not talking about a past figure, but simply is using this prophetic perfect in order to set forth the certainty that the servant will come. Now he begins with the word behold, which is a common word in Isaiah whenever the prophet wants to introduce something of great significance. Behold my servant. And the word my servant there identifies the servant as belonging to God. And that's an essential statement. My servant. Because we are going to see that this servant suffers so greatly that men will regard him as suffering and being punished for his own sins, and as rejected of God. And so it is essential that we know at the beginning that he is God's servant. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. That verb, yaskil, is a causative form, and it means really to use the best means to accomplish the highest ends. It is more than be wise, but it is to deal wisely and effectively. He shall deal prudently. We may render it that way. Now you can see that the verbal form yaskil sounds very much like Yisrael, Israel. And so there are those who say we must engage in textual emendation here and write Yisrael instead of yaskil. Now there is no objective warrant for doing that. None of the versions support that, and none of the Hebrew manuscripts do. It really is not a legitimate procedure at all. There may be a few places where textual criticism is legitimate. We discussed one yesterday where it says, thou hast not increased the joy, and I thought it should be, thou hast increased the joy, because the words sounded the same, lo, in either case. But I do not believe in indiscriminate changing of the text. It really is not an honest way to proceed. But so often the critic says, well, this cannot be the original reading, and then he wants to amend it. But so often also he is influenced by a preconceived notion. Now, it seems to be comparatively harmless when you do that in studying the Bible. But if you receive, when you receive your paycheck, you may look at that and say, I am convinced that the original reading should be something else, and you may make a modification there. If you do that, you're likely to find that the government will be handling your affairs for you. And yet men do that with the Bible right along. And so there are those who say this cannot be right because the passage is talking about Israel. They hold to the collectivistic interpretation, and then they say Yaskil sounds so much like Yisrael that Yisrael must have been the original reading, and they put that in. I do not think that is a legitimate way of dealing with the text. Behold, my servant will deal prudently, it is. And then three verbs are given to show the fullness of his exaltation. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Notice that that last one, be very high, is stative. It does not imply motion. Now some have said that this is clearly a prediction of the exaltation of Christ in the resurrection and the ascension and the session at the right hand of the Father. Well, it's very tempting to see that, but I think rather that the three verbs simply express a fullness, a completeness of exaltation. And they are very necessary because the prophet deals with contrasts, and immediately he plunges us into the situation of the servant's suffering. After this statement then of his complete exaltation, he goes on to say, as many were astonished at thee. He addresses the servant, and yet this is done in a somewhat of an objective term. Many were astonished at thee. Now, our English word astonished is rather weak. It doesn't mean too much. But the Hebrew word, shamamu, means that they were awestruck because they believed the servant had been smitten by God in punishment. The same word is used of Ezekiel by Ezekiel when he describes the destruction of the city of Tyre. Men will pass by the ruins of Tyre, and they will be astonished. That is, they will be dumbfounded. They will be awestruck. They will be stupefied because they think God's punishing hand has come upon the city and destroyed it. So many are astonished at thee. Notice the contrast there, the quantitative contrast between the one and the many. The many are astonished at thee. This is a messianic trait, by the way. It's brought out in classic fashion in the fifth chapter of Romans, between the work of the one affecting the many. Many are astonished at thee. Now, why? Now, that phrase, as many were astonished at thee, is the prothesis of the sentence. And when I say prothesis, I simply mean the first part of a sentence. Let's just take a little lesson in grammar. If he comes, I shall see him. That's called a conditional sentence because it expresses a condition beginning with if. The first part of the sentence, protithony, what is placed first, is the prothesis, if he comes. The corresponding part, the latter part, is the apodosis, which comes from the Greek meaning given afterwards, apodidomi, is I shall see him. That is the last part of the sentence, the apodosis. A sentence like this has a prothesis and an apodosis. Now, if you ever preach on this, don't do what I'm doing and try to explain this to anybody. But at any rate, the prothesis is this statement, as many were astonished at thee, and the apodosis is down in verse 15, the king shall shut their mouths at him. Those are connected by the at thee and the at him, and that's why we shouldn't change that first at thee into an at him. There is the contrast. The many being astonished at thee, the king shutting their mouths at him. The meaning is in awe, reverential awe and wonder. Then in between are two explanatory parenthetical clauses. One, his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. And two, so shall he sprinkle many nations. His visage, that is what can be seen of him, Marehu, what can be seen of him was so marred more than any man. I do not think this means he was marred more than any other man had been, but rather that he was so marred that he was away from man. He no longer appeared as a man. It is a graphic way of describing the sufferings that he had to undergo. And his form more than the sons of men. That is the reason why they are astonished at him, because the terrible sufferings that he had to undergo make it appear that he no longer even looks like a man. Now that's almost an inconceivable expression. I remember once driving in downtown San Francisco. There was a young man with me, and all of a sudden the traffic came to a halt. We realized that something had happened to the car that was two cars ahead of us. A crowd began to gather at the sidewalk, and we finally found a parking place and stopped and went back. And there lying on the sidewalk was the body of a man. The torso had literally been riddled with bullet holes. A gangster had climbed on the running board of a car. Now, when I mention a running board, I realize that I date myself, but let that be. A gangster had climbed on the running board of the car and simply turned his machine gun on the man. There he was lying on the sidewalk. It was as hideous a sight as I've ever seen. I never want to see anything like it again. But awful as it was, that whole body just riddled with bullet holes. Terrible a sight as that was, there was no question but what it had been a man. He was still recognizable as a human being. It'll give you an idea of what is involved here, that this one's sufferings are so great that he no longer resembles a human being. And then right away the reason for that is given. So, that is, in that condition, he will sprinkle many nations. He performs the work of a priest. An expiatory, purifying rite. He does that in this condition. And because of that, even kings will shut their mouths at him, being overcome with awe and wonder, because something has been told to them that is completely new. It is the story, the explanation of the suffering of the servant. That which had not been told them shall they see. That which they had not heard shall they consider. And it is the newness of this message, of the servant's suffering on behalf of others, that causes even the kings to shut their mouths at him in reverential awe and in astonishment and wonder. Here then, in the introduction to this passage, the whole matter is set before us. The salvation is to come through suffering. It is to come through suffering on behalf of others. It is to come through substitutionary suffering. He is to die, and men are to misjudge his sufferings. They think that he is suffering for his own sins. But the great truth that is to be brought out in this chapter is, he is suffering for their own sins. And that is the newness of the message. The salvation that God has planned for this world is not to be brought about through human progress or the general progress of civilization or through the righteous acts of many men, but simply and solely through one act of redemption on the part of the servant of the Lord.